All right. This morning we're going to talk about postmodernism, and I think that it's a term we hear a lot more discussion of, a lot more concern with. We recognize postmodernism because it is much more extreme than modernism. But I do think, as we get into this, I just want to say, I think we, particularly in conservative circles, we suffer more from modernism than we do postmodernism. Now, postmodernism is all around us, and it is affecting us. It is the enemy at the gates, but sometimes we don't recognize maybe the enemy within, you know, what we are struggling with. So, I don't want to just point to postmodernism and say, here's the real problem. No, we're suffering from the problems of modernism. And what we're going to see is that postmodernism is not utterly distinct from modernism, but rather it is a logical progression from modernism. It is the taking to extremes some of the faulty assumptions that were already there with modernism. And we'll make those connections as we go along. But I want to start with talking about the history of postmodernism. Postmodernism as a term doesn't come along until relatively recently. Really, in the late 1970s is the first actual usage of that. And really, it's being discussed in academic circles at that point. And it just, even more recently, only kind of flowed out into popular culture. But the concepts of postmodernism have been around for a long time. The seeds planted and so forth. And we're already talking about those with modernism and so forth. But really, as you think about the history and the development of really the philosophy, the identifiable philosophy of postmodernism, it really comes after World War I and World War II. Talked about modernism, the idea that we're always getting better and better, and we're moving to this great utopic society. And then comes along World War I. And all the hopes and dreams, everything that we thought was going to happen, came crashing down in bloody destruction. It is hard for us to convey how shocking World War I was to the people, to most people in the world who thought things were moving in this grand arc of history, moving towards greater and greater moments. To give you an idea of the shock factor, Belgium, who was one of the most affected, the most destroyed countries in World War I, built a fort. They built the fort to withstand the heaviest munition that at that time was available, which I think was a 16-pound cannonball. So their fort could withstand the battery of a 16-pound cannonball. Not long after it was built, when World War I started, Germany had developed a munition that weighed more than the cannon that shot the 16-pound cannonball. It destroyed the fort in one shot. So you're talking about a leap of technology that was inconceivable to people. The first men who used machine guns in warfare could not believe the destruction that they themselves were wreaking, that they were taken aback by what they were seeing. And so men, when we talk about, you've heard the term shell shock, men came back from World War I and they were shocked. All of this technology, this progression that we thought would lead us into greater philosophies and greater understandings of humanity had been put toward killing each other and maiming and destroying each other. It was the exact opposite of what they thought was going to happen. Well, there were some people who persisted in their modernist hopes. Woodrow Wilson, who vies for one of the worst presidents of the United States of America, entered into the war because with a modernist mind, he thought, we need to be in the war because when it's over, I need to be a part of that process because we can fix this. The League of Nations will fix it all. We're going to get together. We're going to get the best thinkers in the world together. The League of Nations is going to solve all of these problems. Are you familiar? Do you know where the League of Nations is headquartered today? It is not in existence. Not only did it not fix things, it made things worse. So World War II comes along, and people are like, you can't be serious. We can't be doing this again. And so if there were any lingering doubts after World War I that we were moving to a better place, World War II smashed the rest of the hopes. And people are like, okay, it's over. None of that is true. Now what? Well, the now what is people started just questioning and saying, is there any hope? We already threw away God, right? That we threw away that a long time ago. And now we've had to toss our hope in man. And so there's really no hope after all. Now, what's interesting is that quite some time before all of this, a man named Friedrich Nietzsche came along. And Friedrich Nietzsche, let me say, nothing I say in the next few minutes means I am a fan of Friedrich Nietzsche. But I do respect what he has to say. Friedrich Nietzsche he dies a madman. But before he became a madman, I think, he wrote a book called The Madman and several others, in which he said the famous phrase, the thing Nietzsche is most famous for saying. Does anybody know besides Sam what he's most famous for saying? Out of chaos comes order. Is second most, maybe. God is dead. God is dead is the most famous phrase. And usually that's posted up as he is saying this as a boast. Like, you know, we've arrived and now we realize God is dead. It is not. It is a great lament. Now, there's a lot of great comebacks to that. God is dead. God is still around and now Nietzsche's dead. You know, there's a lot of those. My favorite is Marshall Keble's in a sermon one time. He was talking about this and he said, somebody came and told me God is dead. And I just told him I was talking to him this morning and he didn't even say he was feeling poorly. So yeah, that's a clever line. It's a good comeback. But that's not his point. His point is that as a society, we have destroyed any influence God has over us. The entirety of the quote is, God is dead and we have killed him. And it's the idea of, he's living in German society, he's living among the liberal theologians, he's living among the philosophers who have continued down the paths of modernism and the belief in our ability to establish something. And he says, you are all fools. You don't know what you've done. You have removed the foundations and you're all sitting around acting like you're still standing on solid ground. And you are standing on nothing. And what he saw is if you take away God, you take away the center of everything. Now, he didn't believe in God. I'm not saying that Nietzsche was out there preaching that we ought to return to a belief in God, which is why he ended up a nihilist, which is why he ends up in this terrible state of thought. But what he did realize was what God was doing for society. And he said, all this stuff, all of these advances, all of this technology, you don't get to keep this life without God. And he saw it before anybody else. That's why I respect Nietzsche, is because he was a man who was honest with the consequences of his philosophy. There are not many atheists who are. Now, that doesn't lead you to a good place. He doesn't have the answers. And that's postmodernism in general. Postmodernism, as we will see, has some valid concerns and criticisms. It does not have the answers. And I will also say this, it is always easier to see the problems than the answers. So we need to humbly acknowledge that this is a truth. And it is a truth that I think even sometimes Christians don't see, that if you remove God, you remove the foundations. And even if it doesn't collapse immediately, what you are doing is guaranteeing that it will collapse. I think about this like what God said in the garden. Sometimes people contemplate this. On the day you eat of it, you will surely die. And then, of course, what happens on the day that they eat of it? Well, they don't just drop dead, do they? But they surely are dead. And because there's a delay, we contemplate, well, what did that mean, spiritual death? I think it means everything. You are dead. And you think, yeah, but they kept living. But that's the problem. We think if something doesn't happen immediately, then it's not true. Even if it takes 100 more years, I guarantee you the society that throws out God will fall. Period. And Nietzsche knows it. And sometimes we still don't. So give him credit for that. He saw it coming. Well, coming back to World War I, World War II, coming out of that, people come home and they really began questioning things, questioning all of the assumptions about how we were moving to a better place. Some of the philosophers that began to emerge in this sort of questioning are Jean-François Lyotard, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida, Richard Rorty. Those are a few of the key academics who developed those ideas in the universities. And yes, they all sound French. And yes, we can blame France for lots of bad philosophy. But because of the discontentment with the state of the world, these philosophies found quick acceptance among university professors and very much among students. Because if somebody comes and says, the world has gone mad, in this environment, it wasn't a hard sell, right? So here you had people saying it's getting better and better. The American experiment is working. Look, we're progressing. We're solving all the world's problems. And now all of it comes crashing down. And these guys say it was all a big lie. And the young people are going, you got that right. And so they're not wrong on some observations there. They were able to easily poke holes in some of the philosophies. It spilled quickly from the universities into popular culture. And again, it melded well with previous modernist assumptions about what is relative and what is subjective and so forth. It is often, however, in modernist circles, in conservative circles, represented in the shallowest possible terms. Nothing is absolute. Well, I got an answer for that. Are you absolutely sure about that? Got him. Nailed it. We've destroyed postmodernism. You have not destroyed postmodernism, right? You have pointed out a big gaping hole, granted, but you've not destroyed the premises. And part of why we've not destroyed the premises is there is truth. There is truth in the critique that has to be dealt with. So I realize that there's absurdity. But the great difficulty with false philosophies is that they contain a grain of truth. Is that there's something there that you can grab hold of. The devil's lies are never 100% lie. There is something that he is saying that there is truth to. So we need to be careful that we don't just mock and dismiss so entirely so that some young person over here who sees that grain of truth and what they hear us saying is that there's nothing true, then they go, well, I see something true. And then because they see something true, they swallow it hook, line, and sinker. What we need to be doing is saying, yes, that is true. And let me show you how to separate that from all the falseness that's surrounding it. To walk them through that. In Genesis chapter 3, when Satan says, on the day you eat of it, you shall surely not die. Is there some truth to that? There is. He says, God is afraid that you will become like him. Is there any truth to that? God uses the same language at the end of the chapter. They will become like us. No, not in probably all the ways Satan meant it and offered it, and not in all the ways probably that Eve hoped that it would be true, but there was something about that that was true. And we need to acknowledge it, point it out, and show how where the falseness is in it, because certainly Satan was lying, and certainly postmodernism is telling lies as well. Well, what are some of the core tenets? What is postmodernism saying? Postmodernism, as I already suggested, is built on and extends the foundations of modernism. So modernism says it points to universal truth, but it points to human reason as the way to find truth. And therefore, it breaks down fundamental authoritative structures from which truth flows. Truth in modernism flows from you, from your mind. Postmodernism says you're right, but then that means truth is going to be different from one person to the next. So while modernism says it, we find it here, it starts here, its foundation is here, but we can arrive at some universal ethic and so forth, postmodernism recognizes that no, if it starts here, we're never going to arrive at a universal ethic, but that's okay. Right, so postmodernism just destroys the notion of universal truth by using the premises of modernism. It takes modernism seriously and then extends it to its logical consequences. If truth starts with you, then truth will always be contextual. It says that humans are always going to be clouded by layers and layers of environmental factors. We can never unwind them. And so the best we can do is discover our own truth. So obviously from this flows to speak your truth. What is your truth? What is this person's truth? They would say that language, for instance, which flows from individual people, language is arbitrary and confusing, and therefore can never communicate absolute truth. Now, is language confusing? Sure. Have you ever said to someone, we need to have a face-to-face conversation because things get lost as we have text messages? You ever said that? You are conceding, and I think rightly so, a postmodernist critique. That when we use the medium of language, when we write something down and hand it over to something else, inevitably something we haven't fully communicated, right? Now, do you see the problem that might lead to? If we admit that, yes, there's a difficulty in communicating through texts. The text is all we have, isn't it? So we're admitting a problem, and then we have to deal with the consequences of admitting that problem. The problem we admitted is, in fact, true, that it's difficult. Now, one of the ways that we deal with that is we say the difficulty of communicating through text has to do with who's writing the text. This text is written by God. So that already puts it into a different categorical consideration. But even there, we must acknowledge that there is difficulty. Does anybody ever have, are there any difficult passages? I think sometimes, again, with our modernist mind, we might just say, why isn't it just plainer? Maybe, because as Brother Joe pointed out, something is being communicated that we don't have a reference point for. And so, y'all remember Joe's talk about heaven, about communicating? So the Holy Spirit is communicating. We are the problem again. He is trying to communicate infinite realities to finite creatures. Now, I don't mean that he can't, but it just illustrates the difficulty. So we can acknowledge that. We can acknowledge there's a difficulty without saying, well, then you can't know anything. Caleb Westbrook, talking about this, gave the illustration of a professor that was trying to convey this idea how we can have no precision in our communication. He said, if I say, think of a dog, picture a dog in your mind. And so then he says, is the creature you're picturing, does it have white hair? And a few students raise their hands. Or does it have different colors, some brown, some white? Other students raise their hand. Does it have spots? Other students still. Does it have long hair? Does it have short hair? And what he showed is that there's no consistency in the image that is created. And so what they're doing is they're using language that is, in fact, a little vague to show that we have no precision in language. Now, of course, this is not hard to push back on. If I say, think of a Dalmatian, right, we've reduced that whole problem, right? We've done away. But even still, if we go back to the more imprecise term of dog, we still have constraints. You weren't thinking of a cat, right? So there were still boundaries even with that terminology. But we need to admit language is not always precise at the same levels, that there is always going to be a degree of imprecise language. We have said, if you get up and preach and you say, the Koine Greek is the most specific language that has ever been used, stop doing that. It is not. There are ways in which it speaks with more specificity than language, and there are ways in which it speaks with far less specificity than English. Again, languages have differences like this, and we just need to acknowledge that. And there are some times where we're going to be able to say, this is a very specific word in Greek. And then there's going to be some times where this phrase, as my brother Larson Plotter likes to say, he says, sometimes somebody asks him a tough question about a word, and he said, I just say, range of meaning, and I run away. Words can mean lots of, one word can mean lots of things. And so we just acknowledge that. And you say, what does it mean here? Well, maybe we can narrow down the possibilities. And Marshall's been using some of that language this week in Acts, right? I mean, in Romans. Is he's going through and he's showing us, here's some possibilities. And there are times where you can't just say, here's the last word and I'll hear nothing else about it. He's not being a postmodernist, but he is acknowledging some of the criticisms, honestly, that postmodernism makes. Okay, modernism, we talked about, believes in grand narratives, that the world is moving towards something. Postmodernism says, no, it's all chaos. And we've just made up stories about the chaos to make ourselves feel better. The best we can do is find a narrative that helps us cope. And again, I would suggest to you that when modernism threw out the grand narrative that God had ordained, when it said, this is not the grand narrative, we don't receive it from authority, but we discover it. The postmodernists took them at their word and said, if that's not the grand narrative, then look around you. What we actually have is everybody telling their own narrative. And they're not wrong. If God's narrative is not true, then we are just throwing out made-up stories, and we're pretending that they're grand narratives. And really, they're just what we'd like to be true. So, again, the postmodernist is saying that's fine. Like, that's all right. He's not worried about that, but he's just saying that's the reality. If we don't have this unifying grand narrative, then what we really have, and this is Nietzsche's will to power. If you heard the term will to power, that's a Nietzschean concept, the will to power. The will to power is sort of your driving force. It's the thing that makes you want to grow and reach, and it's individualized, right? Everybody's got their own reasons and their own motivations, and basically we make up morals and ethics that allow us to do the thing that we want to do. Again, Nietzsche wasn't wrong about basically the way society works. And so to make ourselves feel better, we say, well, I'm doing that, and then we place some noble reason over here, but really we're just doing the thing that we want to do. And what Nietzsche's hope was, as he saw this hopelessness because we've killed God, what Nietzsche hoped is that one day there would be the evolution of the Übermensch. Have you heard of that term, the Übermensch, the Superman, right? And so one day a man would be evolved enough that we've taken our faith away from God, but we need something to follow. We need some unifying principle to follow. That will be the Übermensch, who's going to come along, and his will to power will actually be worth following. Again, can I say he's not that far off? Yeah. Josh. An Übermensch did come. He did come, and his will to power was good enough for us to follow. The problem is Nietzsche just didn't believe in him. And most of the world doesn't. So you throw away the grand narratives, you end up with just individual narratives. Modernism believes in the ever-increasing ability of human reason and progress to discover new and better truths. Postmodernism rejects that notion that we even know what progress is. All we can do is discover more emptiness. The best progress we can hope to accomplish is individual human actualization. So his actualization, her actualization, Zer's actualization, whatever it is, just individual actualization. The self, then, is also detached. Even the very concept of self is detached from reality. Even that is a construct. As far as historically, right, we've got this picture of the goal is to get to heaven, right? The goal is to be with God. When you take that away, then what's the goal? It gets reduced often down to pleasure. It gets reduced to affirmation of who I am and my identity. And all along, what's happened is technology has allowed them to say, I can really be whoever I want to be. And reality itself doesn't constrain me in my identity. Because now we have technology that says I can actually go to a doctor and have him change who I am in physical, tangible terms. Now, none of that's true, right? But what they would say is even our biological observations, you know, the modernist answer is there are chromosomes, right? You're still a woman. You're still a man, regardless of what. All of that, even your categories, your chromosomes and so forth, all of that's arbitrary. It's all social construct. And let me say, if you throw out God, they're not wrong. It is all arbitrary. And so they're taking up the modernists on the premise of these things being arbitrary. And they're saying it's all infinitely malleable. Modernism measures human progress by technology and human comfort. Postmodernism measures it by self-fulfillment. That's the only goal. Modernism exalted the ability of the right of the individual to seek out truth for himself. Postmodernism then amplifies this to the total sovereignty of the individual. Not only can the individual seek truth for himself, he can invent it as he goes along. It is his truth. Modernism believed in the human control over nature for the betterment of man. We can control nature. We can fashion it however we want to. Postmodernism says nature itself is a malleable illusion and it is therefore subject not only to individual interpretation, but even individual control. This is the point of Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. That how did we get to a point where somebody says, you know, you have to respect my pronouns? That's basically saying the individual reigns supreme. And the rights of the individual, you know, so that this person right here can be affirmed and have his rights, I would destroy the rights of everyone else around him. And so, again, that goes from modernism's assumption that the rights of the individual, right? Individual rights. Do we believe in individual rights? I think we need to be careful. I do, but I think that needs to be moderated. And I think we need to be careful that we don't exalt the individual right. That sort of thinking, and I'll just tell you, that sort of thinking, the exaltation of the rights of the individual leads to people not understanding God's word on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. God's teaching on marriage, divorce, and remarriage is not about individual rights. It is about what the devaluation of marriage does to creation, what it does to whole cultures. And we're saying, but what about this one person suffering? It's not just about that one person suffering. It's about everyone who will suffer. And if you don't understand that, look around. It is not hard to see that exalting the suffering of the individual has caused us to ignore the realities of what God is saying about the family. And then finally, modernism began to question received wisdom and said to study it with skepticism. Take wisdom. Don't just assume that people in the past knew what they were talking about. And it goes even further than that. It more says, assume they don't know what they're talking about, right? Study them with extreme skepticism. Postmodernism comes along, and it rejects all wisdom as mere individual perspective. Right, no longer is it studying it to determine whether or not it's right or wrong. It's just saying, whatever, that's just some dead white dude. Who cares what he thinks? And so where modernism began to question those authorities, postmodernism comes along and says, why even study those authorities? Because we can figure it out. We know better what's good for us than some guy who lived 2,000 years ago. And so they don't even open the ancient wisdom, much less evaluate it. How does this play out in America? Are we a postmodern country? Let's look at some of the ways. One is that we had talked about yesterday about how education changed from values education to, quote, facts education. Well, if the facts themselves are not our social constructs, then what education becomes is merely a platform of affirmations to help the individual figure out what they want and how they want to think about themselves and the world and so forth. So we went from studying Western civilization. Western civilization is about, it's what we're doing in this, in really the modernism. How did our culture come to be what it is, right? Who are the thinkers? What are the thought processes and influences that got us to where we are now? Postmodernism comes and it says, let's study who you want to be. And so you get queer, feminist, whatever studies, you know, it becomes more and more tailored to the individual mindset and what do you want? How can we affirm what? And so no longer is education about let's look back and let's learn from the wisdom that has come before us. It is let's affirm why we've thrown all that in the trash can. And so I will say to you, what education, this further divided education, all right, it divided it into degrees that will actually get you a paycheck and degrees that will simply make you a self-absorbed, crazy person. And so universities, at best, are trade schools now. And at worst, they are indoctrination centers that take away your ability to think well. When we look at the education system, if somebody wants to go, I remember years ago when we were, Marshall and I were in Fiji, and we were walking down the road with Lisa, and to give you a little bit of context, this guy had come up. He was a cross-dresser, and Lisa was just furious. And she said, she saw Fiji changing. And she says, when I was growing up, this would not have happened. And I think we said, what would somebody have done? She said, punch him in the face. Just wouldn't allow it. Well, a little bit later that night, we were walking, and Abraham, Marshall was talking with her grandson about what he wanted to do when he grew up. And he wanted to be a pilot or an actor. And yeah, somebody just said it. Ooh. So we talked about, you know, going to school and going into the arts in school. And Marshall goes, that guy back there was probably an art student. It's not wrong, is it? That's pretty much what you can expect. Used to, being an artist meant you studied masters. You became a skilled craftsman. Now, it means you ignore the masters. You tape a banana to a wall, and you call it art. It's nonsense. So we've destroyed education. What was left of it, we destroyed it. Identity politics and social fragmentation. No longer do we have competition of ideas or competition of narratives. Rather, we have the affirmation of all narratives. But, of course, competition is inevitable. And we've simply shifted the means of determining the measuring of narratives from revelation or empiricism to grievance. Whoever is the most aggrieved gets the most attention. And so we end up in competitions of how many aggrieved identities we can stack on top of each other. This person is aggrieved because he's a minority. Oh, well, this person is a minority and female. Oh, well, this person's a minority and female and homosexual. Oh, well, this person, right? So you just keep stacking them up, and it literally is a competition to see who is most aggrieved. And suffering is the thing that makes your story most genuine. And so we come up with narratives that show that we are the greatest of sufferers. It turns us into a nation of victims. There are no narratives to which we can all subscribe. The best we can hope for is to make room for as many narratives as possible. And the only narrative we reject is the one that says there is one narrative. Which means the most malleable and indistinct narratives will survive. The narratives that have something solid to say must go first. Postmodernism, again, has combined with technology to create the illusion of total control over one's own narrative. Social media allows you to have your own platform. I see that. I see this among Christians. Somebody will post something, and then they'll get some blowback. And they'll say, I was just posting this on my own wall. What? If you wrote it on your own wall in your home, no one would have read it. You wrote it in a place where literally the whole world could see it. It's not your wall. But that radical individualism has made me think it's my space. That used to be, you know, some of you younger guys, that was what it was called, right? My space. The algorithm presses you into a sheltered place where you don't have to consider alternative ideas that would challenge your thinking. I can just cultivate my own reality where I don't have to come in contact with challenges. Gaming allows infinite customization of your reality. I do not like video games. I mean, I think they're enjoyable. I don't like their effect. I even think Minecraft is problematic because you are saying to your children, it sounds so hopeful, build your own world. The possibilities are endless. Okay, tell them to build something in real life. And then they will understand that there actually are constraints. And you do have to work within realities and your own limitations and understand that there is a reality that you work within. Again, I'm not saying you've made your children fully postmodernist by allowing them to play Minecraft. I'm just saying that is not reality. And we need to help our children touch grass, as it were. Ultimately, it promotes less and less notion of conforming yourself to reality and more conforming reality to yourself. And that is a great problem. Of course, popular culture is rife with postmodernism. Stories are made more open for individual interpretation. Stories are made that simply are meant to confuse. Somebody walks away from a movie, I'm not even sure what that was about. That was the point. They don't want it to have purpose and meaning. They want it to disorient. They want to subvert everything. There are no traditional narratives. You know, I hear this all the time when a movie comes out and it's just a straightforward story. It's just, you know, it's so predictable. I know, I love it. Like, tell the good old stories. I told somebody I like to read Louis L'Amour. And they said, it's the same story. And I said, I know, I love it every time. Every time the good guy walks in and he shoots the bad guy and he saves the, you know, great. I want that story. No, we can't have that story. We got to have gritty bad guys, or good guys, and complex bad guys. And I'm not saying that those things don't exist, but they don't give you any resolution. What we don't want is redemption in our stories anymore. We don't want hope. We want to be affirmed in our nihilism. Everything is terrible and there's no hope. Any of you read the book 1984? Any of you read the book That Hideous Strength? All right, far less of you have read That Hideous Strength. That's C.S. Lewis's alternative to 1984. He writes what's called the Space Trilogy. It's the third book in that trilogy. It takes place in a university town, and it is the forces of good and evil. And there's a government organization called NICE, NICE, and it's got all the same doublespeak that you see in 1984. But the good guys win. And George Orwell's comment to C.S. Lewis was, "You cheated. You brought God in and let the good people win." And Lewis said, "That's the point." We want the nihilism. And 1984 ends hopelessly. That there is, because there's no God, there is no hope. Which, if there is no God, there is no hope. But there is a God. So we have all of that. And very often, we don't know how much we're participating in it. Our reaction to it is a great example of our indoctrination. So there's a play, there's a musical that lots of people love that was recently made into a movie called Wicked. I abhor the musical, the movie, the book, everything about it. When I see someone wearing a shirt, first of all, when I see somebody wearing a shirt saying wicked, I think to myself, that's good. That's helpful. The McGuire, the man who wrote the book, is a homosexual who is an absolute postmodern relativist, moral relativist. And his goal was to, he said, to write a story about somebody that was universally considered wicked and to show that there are ways of thinking about that that might make her not so wicked. All right? Now, people watch that, and what they hear and what they see and what they think is, look, it's a good redemption story. It shows us that there's complexities and all of those sorts of things. All right. Frank Baum wrote the book, Wizard of Oz. In fact, series of books, Wizard of Oz. And he wrote them actually as a political treatise. It was a treatise about populism and about the gold standard and the I don't know if you know much about that sort of William Jennings Bryan and so forth, but the William Jennings Bryan's case was that staying on the gold standard only helped the rich people, and that moving towards a silver standard would help the little people, the munchkins. That would help the little people. I mean, seriously, that's what they represent. And so Baum was supporting this political philosophy. And I can't go in, I don't even understand how all that was going to help, but that's what they thought. And so the scarecrow represents the farmers who think they don't have a brain. The tin man represents the industrial workers who think that their hearts have been ripped out, they're soulless. And then the cowardly lion represents William Jennings Bryan, who, if he would just have the courage, could stand up and do something about all of this. The silver slippers, and they were silver slippers in the book, represent the silver standard. And so here they are all going to the city of Oz, which is ounces, because 16 ounces was the standard, right? So that they're going to the city of Oz to go see the wizard who's got all the answers. And as it turns out, he has no answers. And in fact, the farmer, the scarecrow, needs to realize that he does have a brain and he is capable. And the tin man needs to realize he does have a heart, and the lion needs to realize he does have courage, and Dorothy needs to realize that she can get herself home. You don't need the wizard to help you out. All right, now, what does all of that matter? A man wrote a story with a purpose, with a point to make. And the postmodernist says, none of that matters. I can do with this story anything that I want to. I can retell it and give a backstory. And I hear Christians say, it's like the backstory to Oz. No, it's robbery of somebody else's work. But people do it with the Bible every day. They rob God's intentions and they use it for their own purposes. They retell his stories. I don't know how many preachers I've heard get up and tell Jesus' parables to make their own points and not the points of Jesus. And they give backstories on all the characters and they tell you how we arrived here. And you think, I don't think Jesus meant for this guy to have a backstory. I think he told the story he wanted us to hear. And he had a point that he wanted us to make. And you are engaging in postmodernism when you think, I can take that and I can run with it. It's not yours. It is his. And we need to respect that even more than we need to respect the Wizard of Oz. But still respect the Wizard of Oz. Pardon? But not wicked. No. Disrespect that. Okay. All right. Now here's maybe the most unexpected point I want to make. Support for postmodernism. I want to end by acknowledging some of the valid critiques of postmodernism. I believe Ecclesiastes is postmodernism with a caveat. If Proverbs represents a worldview that says, if you behave this way, this will be the result. Ecclesiastes comes in and says, it doesn't always work that way. And I think both of those are true. I don't think we need to throw Proverbs into the trash can because of Ecclesiastes. But I think it does need to temper the way we interpret Proverbs. The book of Job ought to do that. Job's friends come in and they look at Proverbs as absolute statements. And they look at Job and say, you are suffering, therefore you must be wicked, because books like Proverbs, the wisdom of the ages, says, if you behave yourself, this sort of thing won't happen. And Job's going, I don't know what to tell you. I'm behaving myself and it's happening. And so how do we... Proverbs really doesn't tell you how to deal with that, but Ecclesiastes does. Now, what Ecclesiastes does do is it presents that worldview under the sun and says, if it goes no higher than the sun, all of this is vanity and hopeless. That is Nietzsche. That is the postmodernists. But it is not Solomon, because Solomon says, but that's not all there is. And so his hope is not found in human progress. It's not in more accomplishments. It's not in wisdom. All the things that modernism says will eventually satisfy us, Solomon says none of it will. And so he lines up with the postmodernists and says, all of your assertions are empty. But Solomon then comes along and says, but God, here is the one thing that will provide satisfaction. Ecclesiastes, I think, Mike Wilson's talked about, he uses this book in evangelism. Ecclesiastes, I think, is one of the most effective books at helping people see that the Bible understands what they're thinking. Solomon gets what you see in the world around you, but he offers you a path out. He doesn't leave you there in your despair, which is where postmodernists leave you. So, it's emptiness and meaningless in most narratives, and in fact, all but one. Additionally, as we said, Job, he questions the proverbial view of life. His friends unquestionably maintain it. Obviously, Job is in the right there. Jesus subverts traditional narratives. I think Jesus' whole teaching is rooted in subversion. But it's subversion so that we get back to the truth. It's not subversion for its own sake. It's not just let's undermine what everybody's always thought just to destabilize. It's actually to bring us to a more stable place. I even think it's possible to interpret something differently than the original intent. Now, that one's difficult. In Matthew 27 and verse 37, I say this because I think it's important to acknowledge that, especially when we're talking about men, we're talking about things men say, that we understand that the import of something somebody says may be more than they realize. I'll give you an example before we go over to Matthew 27. In the 1980s, who watched the Cosby Show growing up? Or not growing up, some of you were grown, but all right, so several of you watched the Cosby Show. I don't know if you remember the first episode, but in the first episode, Theo has gotten a C or a D. I think he got a D. And so Cliff, Bill Cosby, comes into his room to let him have it. And Theo says, Dad, listen, I realize you and Mom are A and B kind of students. Like you, that was who you were. But that's not me. I'm a C and D student, and you just got to appreciate who I am and let me be me and you be you. And there was you know, kind of there was a studio audience, and there was moderate applause as Theo finished his speech. And his dad looks at him and says, "Son, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And you are going to go to school tomorrow, and you're going to work hard, and you're going to bring your grades." The audience roared with applause. The producer, Marcy Carsey, who was a postmodernist and a liberal, meant for everybody to be on Theo's side. She was shocked when the audience roared in applause with the dad. Y'all remember Family Ties? Michael J. Fox, Alex P. Keaton was his character. Alex Keaton was a conservative high school student with hippie parents, subverting the narrative, right? Not the liberal parents, the conservative son. He was meant to be the villain foil against these enlightened parents. Everybody hated the parents, and it shot Michael J. Fox's career into the stratosphere. They didn't mean to tell the story that they actually told. They meant to say one thing, but because of the realities, everybody accepted it in a different way. And we thought, because of the way we think, we thought they were telling a story of good traditional values, because that's where we were reading it from. So they didn't tell the story they wanted to tell. That's possible. In Matthew chapter 27 and verse 37, it tells us that Pilate put over Jesus' cross. What did he say? What's the sign? Jesus, King of the Jews. Do you think that was out of complete reverence for Jesus? No. He's making a dig at the Jews. But was it true? They placed a crown of thorns on his head. But they were still putting a crown on his head. They put a purple robe to mock, but they still put the purple robe. They went through mocking motions to mock the notion that he was king. But what they were saying was true things. It really was the king. So God subverts narratives. God takes people's stories, and now he gets to do that. We see other places, for instance, John chapter 11 is another example. In John 11, and there in verse 49, one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation should perish." Now he said this. Now, he did not say this from himself. I don't think that means that Caiaphas didn't want to say that, and it just like was a spirit-filled utterance. I think what it means is Caiaphas didn't understand the impact of what he was saying. He didn't mean it in the ways that God meant it. He didn't understand, you know, somebody might say, they didn't understand what they were saying. Caiaphas didn't understand what he was saying. So again, Yes, that's true. But it's not infinitely true. And that's the whole point of modernism and postmodernism. Modernism might say everything is certain. Postmodernism says nothing is certain. And neither one of them are exactly right. And so we've got to find careful ways to navigate the truths that both of these philosophies are saying while pointing out the errors. All right, we'll talk some more tomorrow about how postmodernism affects our understanding and our preaching. Thank you so much for your good attention.